From WXXI News in Rochester, this is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson. He will be back on Monday. This week, however, we are immersed in the literary world, and for this hour of Summer Book Week, we have the pleasure of talking with two authors who are each out with their first books. We will be joined later in the hour by Lynn Rosen, author of A Man of Genius. Right now, we welcome Rachel Hall to the studio. She is a professor of English at SUNY Geneseo. She has been a published author of short stories and literary nonfiction, and now she is about to publish a book called Heirlooms, an intricately interlinked set of stories about a French-Jewish family through the turmoil of World War II and then their later lives in America. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott.
So glad to have you here. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the book story and about your personal story. This is based on real life events in your own family, on your mother who was born in France and came over here at the end of the war. Talk a little bit first about the real life story as we get into the book.
Okay. So the character Eugenie in the book is inspired by my mother, who was born in 1937. So just right before, you know, the war was came to France, World War II. And then the collection follows her story through the war to America. But of course, it veers off in different ways too. It's fictionalized. But I grew up listening to her stories. And at a certain point, they, you know, got inside my brain and became my stories too. Her stories about coming here and not being able to speak English and listening to the radio and then being teased for not being able to say the TH sound. Mm. And all of those things sort of, you know, stayed in my mind as I grew up and, you know, affected the way I thought about people and the world and that sort of thing.
There is, I think, a shared generational experience in the American Jewish community, those of a certain age who grew up when there were still a lot of Holocaust survivors around, who had those stories imbued into us, certainly was part of my experience growing up as part of that generation as well. Talk to me generationally about that.
I think a lot of us inherited in a certain way those stories. And that's kind of where this idea of the title comes from, Heirlooms. And it's kind of an uncomfortable inheritance in many ways. Although I grew up in Missouri, so there were not a lot of other Jews, not a lot of other Holocaust survivors. And in fact, we really have never talked about my mother or my grandparents as Holocaust survivors because they weren't in camps. But they are survivors nonetheless. It's just sort of a different kind.
That experience of exile, and that's really where the book begins, is with this point in the war where the French have taken part, or where the Germans, rather, have taken part of France, and anybody who's even suspected of having Jewish blood has to be on the move and stay on the move for a while to get away from them. And it starts off in that mode of moving and of survival during the war. How much of that came from real world family experience, and how much of that is fictionalized?
Mostly based on family stories. Although I think we didn't really know all the details, right? I mean, the way that people tell stories, you know, about the past. One of the things that I'm really interested in is the way that stories get kind of tidied up, right? Because they don't want to alarm the listener. I mean, I was a really little kid when I heard some of these stories. And so I think my grandparents, you know, kind of made them a little happier. My grandmother always said, oh, we were so lucky, right? But, you know, it's hard to think about luck in these circumstances because they were also terribly unlucky, right? I've forgotten what your question was. I'm sorry.
about being on the move in in France, and about that experience during wartime.
Yeah, yeah. Also, I think when my grandmother talked about that later in her life, she said, I just left. I just picked up with your mother, and I didn't have any money or any food. I just got on the train, and we left. And that's really hard to make realistic in fiction, because people would think, well, surely she had some money, or surely she had some food. So, sometimes in order to write the stories, I had to, add those sorts of things that would make them more believable. And I don't know if my grandmother, remembered correctly. It's hard. It's just really hard to tell.
Did you research around that?
Yes, I did. I did. I read a lot. I read a lot of journals from that time period. I tried to interview my family and get more information. There also were a lot of family letters, but much of that information that I was looking for wasn't in those letters. I had to kind of read to get some of the information about, like, what was required to get on a train and travel, for instance, at that time.
Did you travel to France at all? Have you?
I did. First of all, I lived in France for a year when I was in college, so I sort of know, the people and the attitudes and the landscape and, the weather and that sort of thing. And then I've been back several times, so that helped too.
You talk about some of the deprivations and the struggles in the book. The Eugenie character loses her mother in childbirth and the birth of a sibling, and is actually raised by her aunt. And there's sort of this makeshift family that is created that ends up migrating to America after the war. Was that the real life experience from your family?
Yeah. Well, my mother's mother died of we think was septicemia, something that penicillin would have cured, but it wasn't available. So her mother died when she was quite young, and then her father was in the French Resistance, and so he asked his sister and her husband, who was a Frenchman, to look after my mother, and they did. And that's who I call my grandparents, because I never knew my mother's biological parents. But they weren't able to have children themselves, and so they really wanted my mother, but also then I think felt kind of guilty that they got her. So they adored her, they loved each other, but it was also really a conflicted love.
And there's that touching scene towards the end of the book where the granddaughter goes back to France, tries to find where her grandmother was buried, and after going around to the cemeteries in town, finds out, we didn't even have room to keep all the graves here, so the bones were dug up and taken elsewhere.
Yeah. And that is true. My mother went back as an adult to try to find her mother, and she was, there was no grave, there was no marker, so, yeah.
There are these themes of deception, or at least trying to gloss over things, that resonate through the book, not only on the question of how do you clean up stories that you tell after the fact, but in the case of one of the characters who dies fairly early in the book, his mother is still alive in Palestine well into the 1950s and 60s, and the rest of the family keeps sending her letters because they don't want to tell her that her son has died.
Yeah, that's also based on a true family story. And when I first heard it, I thought, this real person's mother must have been, dying and only around for a little while longer. And then as I researched more, I discovered, that she'd lived on for 15 years and
never knew.
Yeah. We don't know if she knew. I mean, you kind of wonder if she did in a way. There was, all kinds of geographical distance, so she couldn't know for sure. But I started thinking about the other kinds of distance that was created by that lie. So
we are talking with Rachel Hall, who is a professor of English at SUNY Geneseo and is the author of the upcoming book, Heirlooms. It is her first book, and she is with us as part of Summer Book Week here on Connections. We welcome your calls, too, at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. There's another sort of archetypal piece of the Jewish American experience as the family makes their way to California after the war, and they experience this incredible amount of success as in this case, as the manufacturer of a line of soaps, and they become very American and not particularly all that French or all that Jewish. And that's something that is a real world experience for a lot of families that survived that.
Right. Yeah. That isn't my family story. but I wanted to give these characters something. I felt like they'd been through so much and their lives were so sad. I thought, why not let them get rich, you know, let them have that, the satisfaction of coming to America and getting that part of the American dream, even if, you know, in all these other ways, they don't have full happiness.
And it is, even if it's not necessarily part of your family's story, I mentioned before the show started, my wife's family came from Germany right before the war, and they ended up in Nebraska and did incredibly well in the beef business in Nebraska because her grandfather, her great-grandfather had been a cattle buyer.
Oh, wow.
In Germany. So it is definitely, it's a real world experience. Let's talk a little about the process of writing a first book. Some of the pieces of this had been stories that had been published elsewhere. I know one of them was published as far back, I think, as 01. What was the gestation period of this?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, and it may be a little bit of an embarrassing question because that first story was published in 2001 in the Gettysburg Review, and I thought I was sort of done with that subject matter. And I was working away on a novel project that I never finished and you know, really sort of struggling with it. And then suddenly this story popped into my head, and it was the very last story in the book, which is the Cemeteries of St. Malo. And then after I finished that, which really came to me quickly and in a burst and was quite a joyous writing experience, I realized, oh, I have the beginning and the end of a linked collection. But I was still, you know, sort of struggling away on that novel, and I thought this will be my next book. And eventually I got pulled into this more firmly. So, yeah, so I people say, you know, how long did it take you to write this book? And I sort of say, you know, I hem and haw, and then I say, all my life. It's taken me all my life. So,
as it actually accelerated towards publication, what have the last few months been like?
Well, I've been writing a lot of sort of personal essays right now about different aspects of the book. One piece just came out in Guernica Daily on Monday, which is about the dying language of Ladino, which is actually the language that was my grandmother's mother tongue, Old Spanish. And so, you know, exploring the book in different ways through personal essay has been really, really fun. But actually, too, I guess the other part of part of that question that I should answer is that once I figured out that I was writing a book of linked stories, I moved a little bit more quickly. I had a sabbatical from Geneseo, and I think I wrote 5 or 6 of the stories then, and then just a couple more in 2014. So,
what differentiates a collection of linked stories from a novel per se? How do you draw that line?
I don't know. I had an agent for this book, and she just called it a novel. And I thought, oh, it's going to be hard to get an agent. It's going to be hard for an agent to place it because nobody likes stories. So she just sort of decided that it was a novel. And I've heard from other early readers that they felt that way, that it moves and feels like a novel. And that's great. I'm glad for that. I think maybe the difference is that each story needs to stand on its own. And I think they do. I mean, a number of them have been published on their own, so that suggests that they do. I don't know. I think it may be finally in the end a marketing term. So I don't know.
Did you make modifications between publishing something as a standalone and making it part of a collection? Are there redundancies that get trimmed away, or is that?
Some redundancies, and I mean, certain stories, in order to place them in individual magazines, I would, you know, cut certain aspects that weren't necessary for it as a story, but, you know, made more sense in context with the other stories.
I found it fascinating, you know, as each chapter began or as each story began, they kind of start off, especially in the beginning, with a whole new different character, and then you kind of back into, oh, okay, this is how they're related to Lise, and this is how
They're
related to the other characters in the book. Was that deliberate, or did that just follow as these having been individual stories?
I don't think that was deliberate. I think maybe, I'm glad it worked that way. I don't think that was intentional. I think one benefit to writing stories rather than a novel is that if you're bored with a particular character, you get to come at it from this other direction. And I think that's what I was doing. You know, I'd get tired a little bit of Lise or Eugenie, and then I think, oh, well, you know, who else would they have encountered in their lives that could tell a story? So
when you're telling stories that are at least based on real people, and especially in the context of a family,
yeah,
I imagine that's got to be an interesting experience than actually presenting it to other family members. What was that like?
Well, my mother has been incredible this whole time with this project. I mean, you know, not only telling me these stories from the time I was young, but also, you know, helping me with the French, since she's a native speaker. She's gone through the book and corrected everything for me in that regard. But she's also been really open and supportive about letting me embellish and fictionalize. And when I say, you know, I did this thing to this character who's you but not you, she says, oh, it's okay. I know you write fiction. So she's been good. And there were really only two instances where I was worried that she might not like what I had done. And so with those stories, I gave them to her, you know, as soon as they were done. And I said, I hope this is not too upsetting, or, you know, let me know what you think. And she was great. She was wonderful with it. So I feel really fortunate about that.
We are coming to the point now where the Holocaust is ceasing to be an experience that was lived by people who are still with us to talk about it and is becoming something in history books. Does that make a book like this, even if it's not explicitly a Holocaust book, does it make telling stories like these particularly important now?
Yeah, I think all kinds of historical information can be, you know, revitalized by story. And these are, you know, this time period is something that I think that people are still really, really interested in, too. So, yeah, I do think that's important.
The book is Heirlooms. We are talking with Rachel Hall, who is a professor of English at SUNY Geneseo, and it will be out fairly soon this fall, right?
September 16th.
September
yes.
16th.
Yes.
So as you get ready for that publication date, what are some of the things that happen next?
Let's see. We're probably looking at galleys and finding more errors and that sort of thing. I've got some events planned just right post-publication in Kansas City, where my publisher is, and in Columbia, Missouri, where I grew up. And then here in Rochester, I'm going to be a part of the Fringe Festival on the 24th of September at the Lyric Theater. I'm going to be reading from Heirlooms, and some of my students are going to be reading their own sort of heirloom stories, things inspired by their family stories. So I'm really excited about that, about sharing the stage with my students.
How does this come back into the classroom now? What does this do for you as an educator, especially since you're teaching what we hope will be the next generation of budding writers?
Yeah, well, my students have been really sweet about it. They're excited about the publication and excited to buy it. And that's been really, really touching. I don't know how it will affect me as a teacher. I guess students will know something more about my family history than they would otherwise. That'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see. But so far, they've been terrifically supportive and excited for me, and that's been great.
Are they readers?
My
students, this generation. We talked about this a little bit on the publishing roundtable, and the topic will come up again. We've got an hour that we're doing on young adult literature on Friday, and talking about, you know, kids especially growing up now in a digital environment.
Mm-hmm.
What are you finding as somebody who's teaching? I mean, I guess they're sort of self-selected if they're already in an English program,
right?
And if
right.
they're at a school like Geneseo, but how is there a generational difference coming up here?
You know, I think people are still reading a lot, and I've been surprised how much my students like a book and like literary journals. And we started a literary journal at Geneseo about 5 years ago, and it was just online for a while. And I thought, well, that's fine. You know, that's how this generation likes things. And they really are so excited when we decided to start printing it. They love the print copy so
right.
much, even if they have to pay for it, right? So I don't think the book in its print form is dying really at all. I think people maybe read differently because of all the screens. I think I worry sometimes that I'm not as careful of a reader as I used to be. We're all kind of impatient and reading quickly or skimming. But I do think there are lots of good readers out there. And and I think, you know, maybe creative writing classes are the place where we can slow people down in their reading and get them to think about, you know, sentences and word choice and image and that sort of thing in a way that they can carry over to the rest of their reading lives.
I will say there are some books that I can read with distractions around me. This was not one of them.
Oh.
This was a turn off the TV, get the kids and the puppy out of the room, and sit down and read. Rachel Hall is the author of Heirlooms. We're going to take a quick break here on Connections Summer Book Week, and we'll be right back. Lynn Rosen will join us as we talk to authors with first books. We'll be right back. On Thursday's Connections, a handoff at Rochester's Writers and Books. Outgoing founding director Joe Flaherty will be here, along with his successor, Kyle Semmel. Then in hour two, Pulitzer Prize winner Richard Russo joins me to talk about Everybody's Fool, the long-awaited sequel to his bestseller, Nobody's Fool. I'm Scott Feibusch. Join me for Summer Book Week on Connections, Thursday at noon and again at 9 on AM 1370 and FM 88.5. It is Connections from WXXI, WRUR, WEOS, and we welcome our viewers on City 12 as well on this Wednesday hour. We are talking with authors who have first books out, or at least in this case, first works of fiction. We've been talking with Rachel Hall, who is the author of the upcoming Heirlooms, and we're joined in studio now by Lynn Rosen, who is the author of A Man of Genius. I guess I should hold these up for TV viewers to see, too, so you can see what we're looking at here. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Let me get you right up by the microphone here so that we can hear you. Excellent.
Am I good? Yes.
You're good. Yes. You are a little unusual as a first-time author because after a very long and fascinating career that's included stints running companies and being heavily involved in some educational ventures, you have turned to the world of literature. It's not polite for me to ask, but you can say.
Oh, I'm very proud of it at the age of 84.
At the age of 84.
Woohoo! Yes.
Man of Genius is I guess you could sort of call it a thriller. It's sort of a personality case study. It's about a famed architect and the women in his life and some mysteries that surround them. And I started reading it and got just a couple of pages in and said, let's see, famed architect, wears a cape, has flowing white hair and a big hat. And it said to me right away, aha, this is Frank Lloyd Wright. I noticed a lot of the reviews of the book didn't necessarily pick up on that right away. How essential is it to know that this is a story that's based on what is already a very dramatic and fascinating story, the real life story of Frank Lloyd Wright?
Well, the story of A Man of Genius and the book A Man of Genius probably never would have come into being if I weren't enamored by Frank Lloyd Wright. But you don't have to know a thing about Frank Lloyd Wright to approach A Man of Genius. And the inception, the idea, grew out of something that happened to me personally at Taliesin and became one of my greatest memories. I mean, we have big memories and little memories. This is a big memory. And over time, it described itself in different ways. And I became very curious about why it stayed with me so long. And the why of it became something that drove me to write the book, not so much the incident, but why did it stay in my repertoire of memories so long, and why was it so prominent?
And the incident was that you actually got a personal tour of Taliesin.
I did, because I got there on a day when it was closed. And I was an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin at the time, because Taliesin is very close in Spring Green, yes, to the Madison campus. And after much difficulty in getting there, because, you know, you had to get a car and all that stuff, and so I arrived on the wrong day. And I was met by accident by Mrs. Wright, Olgavanna Wright, who took me in and gave me the private tour of Taliesin.
Which becomes an episode sort of at the beginning of the book, where one of your protagonists, the lawyer, shows up on the pretense of not knowing that it's closed,
yes,
to do just that.
Yes, but what happens to the lawyer is much different than what happened to me. And after it was over, Olgavanna Wright invited me to take tea with her, and I did. And she asked me, and this is a little vignette in the book, and she said, and what do you think of it now that you've seen it this way? And I said that it was beautiful, but I never wanted to live there. And she said, why not? And I said, because it's too humbling. But during the whole encounter, the thing that drove, I think, embedded this memory was what I really wanted to say that I never said, which was, did your husband really kill his mistress? And that was never said. And out of that, the memory was etched, really.
And this, of course, for people who don't know this whole fascinating story, which involved, as it does in your book in sort of different form, it involved a fire that destroyed a lot of evidence. Mm-hmm. Sketch the broad outline of what happened in the real world with Frank Lloyd Wright and Mamie Chaney.
Correct. Over at, actually, at Taliesin. And it was rebuilt. But the plot line is much different in my book. And some of the attributes of Wright's personality that are very well known are in there, but he becomes something else because it drives the book. It is beyond that.
So this was an incident that happened when?
It was in the, I'd say about 1949, 1950.
And it stayed with you for more than half a century. What prompted it to finally come out in the form of a novel?
Well, you know, I had written all my life. I just didn't realize it until I went back and said, you know, after I wrote the book and said, what am I going to do now? The book was published. And where do I go now? And I went to a file I had, and I realized I had written a lot before. And I even got paid for some of it, mm-hmm, which was remarkable. And so what happened here was I said to myself, what is it that made this book come alive? And I think it was the fact that I truly believe there's something current in what is driving this book. And in giving it some more thought, I've come to the conclusion that it's a question of, I hope it raises a question of our own systems of moral obligation, because the book does not have a clean ending. It leaves you with a question mark. And it leaves you with a question mark about who did what to whom and what would you have done. And further, I think it forces some discussion or consideration of our own personal idols. Where do we find our idols? We find it in media today, in other authority figures. What are our criteria for accepting these people as our idols? What does that say about us? And when our idols end up being flawed, what kind of action do we take, and what kind of forgiveness do we grant them?
We are talking with Lynn Rosen, who is the author of A Man of Genius, and we have Rachel Hall with us as well, the author of Heirlooms. I want to ask you some questions about generation and about gender, because one of the things, if it's not giving away too much about the book, one of the things that we learn about your architect is that some of the most brilliant things that he is credited with doing over the course of his career may not really have actually come from his own pencil.
They came from his own concept. He was a visionary. But you're quite right.
With a lot of uncredited help from...
The vision could not have come about without the wife. And she's never credited for it.
And this is something, I'm presuming, the time frame that we're talking about here is World War II, post-World
exactly.
War II, roughly.
Exactly.
That wouldn't happen today.
No, but I lived through that. You know, I'm not a creature of today. I am of many yesterdays. And so and I did live through it as a professional woman, and I've always been a professional woman, and I understand and feel for that. And the harassment that I experienced was really at some times very acute.
You have had a career that has included stints teaching at the University of Rochester, mm-hmm. serving as dean of faculty. You've lived in Japan. You've worked in public relations. You founded a software company with your son, and then you've been involved in some wonderful programs to help get disadvantaged youth some better educational services, the Rosen Scholars Program and the Rock City Scholars Program. Has some of that real life experience, does some of that come into some of the questions that you ask in the book?
Well, they do. I think that the questions raised in the book transcend that to a certain degree. They come out of what my own set of values that says, what would a fair world be like where everybody plays fair? And having lived through times when people didn't play fair to an even larger extent than today, I think that it does push the book, and it pushes me in many ways. My sadness is that as I go among groups of younger women, that they really don't, they understand, they know of the history, but they don't really sense it in the depth that I lived it. I had a sister-in-law who's now deceased, who was a professional woman, a physician, and she experienced the same thing, and we used to talk about it very often, because she said I would go among younger women, and we really didn't, they don't sense what we went through.
I've had conversations, my aunt was in the advertising business in the 60s and 70s, and when Mad Men first came on, she started watching it. We were talking about it, and she said, I almost can't watch it because I lived this.
Correct.
This was absolutely, people don't realize just how bad the sexism was and how mm-hmm. casual it was. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, it kind of brings back a theme that we were talking about with Rachel in the first half hour, bringing people into these times while there's still a chance for people who experience them to talk about them.
Yes.
And to let them know. I guess it sort of brings me then to that next question. Okay, you have a book that came out this year. Talk to me about the process now of getting it noticed and about getting it out there and making sure that now that you've gone to the trouble of writing it, that people will actually find it in this world where there's so much on the shelves.
Well, I can't speak to that with any wisdom, because that comes in under social media, and I just don't understand it. And so I have people helping me do that. Without that, I don't think anything gets noticed. And it is a problem. It is a real problem. And it I'm so sad about the fact that there are so many talented writers who will never be recognized, not because of their work, but because of the process itself. And I find out so many things that it's manipulative, social media is. And I'm horrified by it, to tell you the truth, and scared of it, too.
It can reward louder voices. On the other hand, it can also be a great opportunity. You know, the reason that Rachel is sitting here today is because I went out on the various social media platforms that we have at WXXI and said, hey, we're doing this. Who am I not hearing from out there? And Rachel connected with me, I think, on Facebook, if I remember correctly, and said, hey, I've got a book coming out. We should talk about it. And so it can definitely, I mean, there is a value to it, too. Now, you published this under your own imprint, right?
Yes, because I have had a book published, a nonfiction book that I wrote with my late husband. And that was published by Plume, New American Library. It had no problem getting it published. And at the age of 84, when I finally finished this book, having the process of writing it took 15 years, 9 of which were in actual writing, but the span of 15 years. And at the age of 84, I didn't want to sit around and wait to find a publisher. I probably wouldn't live long enough. And so I just went out and self-published. And that was it.
So how are you getting it out there? Is there obviously you're here with us.
I've been very fortunate in that I've had some very good reviews. I've had some excellent reviews. And that's like a snowball effect, and people want to read it. There are outlets like a Librarian Journal that has listed me as one of the 6 top new writers. I don't know if they know my age, new writers, old writers, to be watched. And it starts to have what I call in the old PR business, it has legs. And those legs are growing stronger, which is interesting that they're not diminishing, they're growing stronger. In fact, I just got an email this morning that was the third of a series of similar emails from Amazon, where, of course, you can buy the book under Amazon. And it was sent to me personally, and it said, looking at your reading, we would suggest that you buy A Man of Genius. Hmm. And I thought that was an excellent idea.
Absolutely.
So they're pushing the book, and they gave excerpts, huge excerpts from the book, available to the reader. So
there is certainly a Frank Lloyd Wright community out there that is passionate about him. There have been some biographies and some semi-fictionalized versions of his life that have come out in recent years. Are you reaching out to that community at all?
Not at all, because, to be honest with you, it is not his life. That was the impetus for my doing the book. But it leaves the life behind and creates something else. And I don't want it to be anyone to anticipate that this is a life of Frank Lloyd Wright. It isn't at all.
I think, though, from at least from having read it, and I'll put my biases out here. I'm the son of an architect, and I've been to Taliesin, and boy, there's no way you could walk in there now and just knock on the door and get invited to tea. It's become a big business there.
Indeed. Well, all of the places, Falling Water, Taliesin West, all of them.
Absolutely. It seems to me that there is at least an enhancement to it in having known that story.
I agree with you.
The book, it makes the book that much more interesting. I could certainly see it on the shelf at the Taliesin gift shop, if nothing else.
Could you really?
I could. We are talking with Lynn Rosen, who is the author of A Man of Genius, and Rachel Hall, who is the author of Heirlooms. They are both authors of their first novels, and they are with us here on Connections. And we welcome your input as well, 844-295-TALK, if you're interested in joining us. One of the things we've been doing, this being Summer Book Week here on WXXI, is we're asking everybody, what else are you reading this summer? What recommendations do you have for our listeners who are looking for something good this summer? Rachel, what's on your book list?
Well, I couldn't sleep last night in anticipation of the show. And so I read started reading Elizabeth Strout's My Name is Lucy Barton, which is wonderful.
Read it.
I couldn't stop once I started, so that was sort of a bad thing. Yes. But it's really wonderful. I'm a big fan of Elizabeth Strout's. I finished recently Kim Brooks' The House Guest, which is also about World War II and is historical. It's set partly in Utica, too. Mm. So there's a Western New York connection there. And I've been reading Robin Black's Crash Course, where life and writing collide, which is sort of writing advice, but also personal essay. And she's very smart and funny. So that's what I've got on the docket right now.
Excellent. Lynn, what's on your reading table?
Well, I have one book that's been there for years, and I'm still plowing through it. And it was Jacques Barzan from Dawn to Decadence. Ah. I'm trying to learn about the world about me. And I'm reading a very interesting book now. I'm trying to remember the author's name, which, of course, will leave me forever. Mr. Splitfoot. Mm. And it's a fascinating, it has a lot of elements of magical realism in it. And I love that kind of book. And I am going back to reading Du Maurier now. And I always go back to reading a chapter of Tristram Shandy. I keep it at my nightstand because I think that he is just brilliant. And but Mr. Splitfoot, and I read The Lost Chord, the new Geraldine Brooks book.
Oh, right.
Yes, on Daniel, King David. And what else do I have in my book? But the Barzan one is the one that is my deep reading.
You mentioned Du Maurier, and that's a name that's come up in some of the reviews of your book.
Yeah.
What are some of the other literary influences that that came to bear here?
Well, I think that Rosemary's Baby is another one that I think is, because I'm really into the Gothic, and I'm intrigued by the Gothic. I think it's one of the more psychological things, elements, and style that can be applied to literature. And it's interesting what it does to the mind and the body, and this transcendence in these Gothic books into this realm of the sublime and the eerie. And A Man of Genius has Gothic elements in it, clearly.
And it's one of the places where you diverge from the real-life Wright story.
Yes.
And you create,
yes,
Hesperus's Walk, which is this,
yes,
island estate.
Yes. And you find that in a lot of those are elements of the Gothic. And the apprehension of something that's going to happen that's scary. But my theory is that the Gothic changes with time. There is modern Gothic even in James Bond and in these incredible kinds of contrivances that that scare you if they had their full effect, because they're killer agents possibly, and the potential for it. And the Gothic changed because it used to be going over endless seas and things that had feeling of no defined lines about them disappeared as technology advanced. And so when technology advanced, the Gothic elements changed into other things that had these endless possibilities.
And yet you've set the book at a time where there are certain pieces of technology that, helpfully for your story, don't exist. There's no good way of communication from this remote island.
Oh, there can't
where
be.
Where the estate is. There couldn't be after the plot.
There can't be.
You have to hoist a flag and hope somebody sees it across the water.
Well, yeah, and I had to be very careful about scenes like that they made sense. And, because those were very difficult to construct, because you had to have that as the binding element, the seclusion.
We are talking with Lynn Rosen, author of A Man of Genius, and Rachel Hall, author of the forthcoming Heirlooms. And of course, one of the reasons why you're both here, in addition to having first books out, is that you're both local writers here in Rochester. And let's talk for a moment about the Rochester writing community. This is, we're not Brooklyn, or not Berkeley, what is it like writing a book in Rochester compared to trying to do it? And you know, you've both been elsewhere. You grew up in Missouri. Lynn, you've been all over the world. What's the experience like of writing a book here in Rochester specifically?
Well, I've lately found that there are lots and lots of writers in Rochester. Mm-hmm. And I think this, like, understanding that has come about in part because of social media. So while I have some reservations also about social media, I think it's been really great in helping people find, you know, like-minded community. So I've really benefited from that, from meeting other writers, sharing work with them. I've always had readers elsewhere that I shared work with, but it's really nice to, you know, have people here who can look at something for you, you can work with. I've been having regular writing dates with our mutual friend, Sejal Shah, and that's super inspiring, I think, to be accountable in that way.
It's a good place to get a plug in here for the Facebook group that she helped create, the Rock City Lit Meetup.
Right, right. Absolutely. That's been so fantastic. I think it's a really large and vital community. Lots of people doing lots of really interesting things here in Rochester.
Lynn?
Well, I'm from New York City, so it's a whole different world. And in my other incarnation in public relations, I did represent a lot of writers. And it is a much different world. I think that having written the book and now residing in Rochester, what appeals to me is I have a sense of closeness to the readers that I would never have in New York. And it fascinates me. I live in an apartment building, and when the book was published and people heard about it, I would travel on an elevator and somebody would say to me, "I heard you wrote a book. What's it about?" And I said, "How many floors are you going? How much time do I have?" But there is that. And so I get more of an opportunity than I noticed my own clients, the people I represented, had to really talk to readers about the book. And I like that. I think it's wonderful.
Have you been doing readings locally?
No, I don't. I haven't done readings. I've booked some that some people have asked me to. They're not really readings. There are so many clubs here. Book clubs. But the one thing that I do ask that I gladly attend any book club for discussion, but I do ask that the people there have read the book.
It helps.
Well, there are some book clubs that's not their procedure. Somebody reports on the book.
Oh, really?
Yes. And then they go out and decide whether they will read it. And so I would prefer not doing that, but I would gladly attend any group and discuss it with them. So there is a closeness to reader that none of my clients had in New York City that I know of.
It's got to be an interesting experience moving from one side of that window to the other.
Oh, my God, yes. Oh, my God, yes. I represented Rod Serling for many years, and who is a great writer. He was a great writer. And spending the time with him and understanding. I also represented Polly Adler, the great madam, and which was another situation, and Stuart Clutie, the South African writer. And so my experience with them and understanding what they were going through as a writer has really been beneficial to me. But Rochester is a great community to be a writer in because you have a closeness with your readers.
What would you go back and tell yourself as a marketer of books that you might not have known then, that you know now as an author?
Well, don't forget, marketing then was much different, much different. It was it wasn't as multidimensional as it is now. It was a straight shot. You either made it or not. And it was manipulative, I will tell you, because one of my bigger clients was United Artists as they began independent films. And we would have people that we called legmen. who were in cities for new movies coming out go out and buy 10 copies of the book. And so you get on the bestseller list. Now, staying there took the book, had to, you remained there because of the book. You couldn't stay there without the book. But to get it on to the list, it was manipulative. And I think that's been recognized now.
Is it that different from making sure that you have somebody ready to post the first review on Amazon when it goes up and to make sure it's a good one?
No, I think it's quite near the same, but I think you have to stand on your own more now. You won't get away with that very much. Yes.
Lynn Rosen, what's next for you?
Another book. And I have to have another book. It takes me 15 years to write one. I have to have something to look forward to.
We will look forward to having you back on. Lynn Rosen's book is A Man of Genius. And Rachel Hall, Heirlooms, comes out in September.
Yes, September 16th.
We will look forward to that. Thank you both for being with us here on Connections with Evan Dawson. I'm Scott Feibusch. Thanks to our team, including Kat Schwartz, our audio engineer, and our City 12 team as well, and Megan Mack, our producer. We are back with more Summer Book Week tomorrow. Stay with us.